This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld just gave a press briefing at the Pentagon, and he started off by talking about Saddam Hussein.
As his regime collapses around him, the question is asked, where is he? There are three possibilities. He's either dead or injured or not willing to show himself. We may not know if or where he is, but we do know that he no longer runs much of Iraq.
General Richard Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, joined Secretary Rumsfeld at the lectern in the Pentagon briefing room. Myers said that U.S. troops had control of all of the major roads in Baghdad, coming into and out of Baghdad, and to the airport, and have visited, he said, presidential palaces. He went on to say that response from Iraq's Republican Guard was sporadic and that all but a few of their tanks have been destroyed. This evening in Baghdad, shelling by U.S. troops has continued, and the International Red Cross reports hospitals in the city are running short of basic supplies after treating hundreds of injured. This hour, we'll bring you up to date on the latest developments, not only in Baghdad, but in Basra as well, and look ahead to what comes next. President Bush and Prime Minister Blair are meeting today in Northern Ireland to address post-war Iraq. Later in the program, we'll talk with Afghanistan's finance minister about the rebuilding his country has seen in the months since the war ended there and what lessons he may have to offer to the start of the process in Iraq. But first, if you have questions about the latest details in the war, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from the Pentagon is NPR's national security correspondent, Tom Jolt. And Tom, always good to have you on the program.
Hi, Neil.
The Secretary of Defense, just finishing up half an hour ago, painted what can only be described as a very optimistic picture of U.S. progress in the war.
That's right, Neil. I think probably in the best quote in that regard was actually from General Myers when he said, the battlefield has certainly shifted since the last time we were at this podium, which was this past Thursday. Of course, since then, there have been several incursions by U.S. troops into Baghdad, some of them into downtown Baghdad, into the center of Baghdad, others into more the fringes of Baghdad. Interestingly enough, Neil, the Pentagon here is not even quantifying how many incursions that they have made. They're trying to emphasize the point that U.S. forces are, as it were, moving in and out of Baghdad at their will whenever they feel like it, and they, of course, have stayed in some places in Baghdad. Officials here won't be too specific about that, but U.S. forces at this moment are inside Baghdad.
And the picture you get, they also said British forces have just about established control over the city of Basra. The city's old quarter, as yet, as far as I understand it, has not been entered yet by British troops, but that's the one big remaining area they have not proceeded into. And the picture that you get from what they describe is Basra on the verge of falling to British forces. Baghdad seems to be U.S. forces entering at will, whether they be Marines or Army, and cutting off these small units, some of which are involved in very difficult fighting, but not coordinated fighting. Is there anything that you've seen, Tom, that disrupts the picture we're getting of a regime on the edge of collapse?
No, I think that Brigadier General Vincent Brooks, the briefer at Central Command this morning, said something interesting. He did say that local commanders of Iraqi forces, be they Republican Guard or Special Republican Guard or any of the other various formations, are in command of their own forces and are able to direct them into battle. What he said, though, that was interesting is there is no overarching countrywide command structure that is any longer functioning. So, for example, if you as a overall commander wanted to shift forces from the north to the south, from the east to the west, you wanted to move forces you have in the north down into Baghdad or something like that, or forces that you have in the south, you wanted to bring them up, that kind of communication is no longer possible. So the kind of what this means is you get a very decentralized resistance, very decentralized fighting. That's not the kind of fighting that can be sustained for very long. Inevitably, that will be broken down. So this would appear to be a fairly important turn of events. You mentioned Basra. What U.S. forces, interestingly enough, are doing in Baghdad is almost a carbon copy of what the British forces have been doing in Basra for the past several days. One of the reasons that British forces have not been able to get into the old city of Basra is because, like other old cities, the streets there are very narrow. That is the absolute worst place for urban warfare. Baghdad, on the other hand, is a far more open city, and so we may see more success by U.S. forces in Baghdad.
One thing that the Secretary of Defense would not be drawn on, and that was what is being reported as the discovery of what may be some weapons of mass destruction, barrels of stuff that, at least in the initial tests, seems to have tested positive for some kinds of nerve agents. And the Secretary of Defense said, look, we're going to have to check this and double check this. It's going to be days before we know what it is.
That's right, Neil. There have been actually a couple reports here, one from our own John Burnett, who quoted a Marine officer as saying that he had seen an intelligence report, an Army intelligence report, actually citing the 101st Airborne Division, reporting that troops from that division had actually found some missiles, some BM-21 missiles, mm-hmm. With chemical warheads loaded on them. And those chemical warheads actually contained, according to this intelligence report, sarin and mustard gas. That is obviously about a third-hand report, because it's a Marine officer quoting an intelligence report about a 101st Airborne operation. So take that with a grain of salt, if you wish, but it is interesting. And the other report, which apparently is quite separate, also involves troops in the 101st Airborne Division, as you say, finding barrels of chemicals. Now, I heard on television an interview with one of the commanding officers of that unit saying that these chemicals, there may be some non-military explanation for these chemicals, and in any case, there's going to have to be a lot of testing for this. Secretary Rumsfeld and General Myers confirmed essentially that the testing is taking place, but they really did not want to go out on a limb. Of course, Neil, so much is riding on this claim. The Pentagon, and Secretary Rumsfeld in particular, does not want to be caught saying something has been found, only to have to retract it later. So they're being very careful.
And again, to repeat what they said, these reports are preliminary, unconfirmed thus far. But Tom, stay with us. Joining us now is Colin Soloway. He's a reporter for Newsweek magazine, and he's with the 101st Airborne Division. Colin, can you hear me?
Yep, sure thing.
What can you tell us about this alleged discovery of chemical weapons by members of the 101st Airborne earlier today?
Well, it's still a bit unclear at this point. In fact, I think some of the initial findings were actually made yesterday, because we were hearing about this yesterday here with the 101st early as late yesterday evening. It's still really unclear at this point. I mean, having checked with the chemical officers, the officers assigned to each unit whose responsibility is to protect against chemical warfare, none of them had heard anything more than the initial reports, which were that they had found some substances yesterday in a chemical plant which tested positive on some of the initial low-level screening kits that they use. Apparently, they were concerned that one of the kits that they used may have actually been a test kit, so it was showing a false positive. Then they brought in basically some simple paper, which is used to detect chemical weapons like nerve agents. The problem is many of these chemical detection systems, at least the very basic ones, are very, very easy to trick. I mean, things like brake fluid, transmission fluid, and many other kinds of chemicals can actually show a positive for nerve agents on these kits. Now, what everyone was waiting for were for these chemical exploitation teams, experts to come in with more advanced testing materials and to really try and evaluate what's going on. But the last time I spoke with anybody about it, they said that it was just unclear. I mean, one thing to remember is that when troops go into a chemical facility, it's not particularly surprising to find chemicals, and often quite caustic or dangerous chemicals, which can hurt them, can and have many of the same effects as, say, blister agents or other other chemicals. It's certainly not outside the realm of possibility that there are chemical weapons there, but at least here in the 101st, at least the folks that I've been talking to, no one seems entirely sure what this is, whether these are just some nasty chemicals or whether these are, in fact, chemical weapons.
And indeed, pesticides can be very difficult to distinguish from chemical weapons in that they're, in some respects, not all that different, except in their
exactly.
strength. As we go on, and obviously these materials will be tested, and we'll know what they are in a few days. But Colin, I wanted to ask you about another important political development, and that has been what some are describing as a euphoric reaction from residents of Karbala. What response did you see to U.S. forces there?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't been in Karbala today. I'm further south from Karbala. I was just in Najaf today, which has been more or less secured by another brigade of the 101st Airborne. As far as Karbala, I mean, the reaction seems to be fairly, from what I'm hearing, the reaction seems to be quite similar to the reaction that folks got to, in Najaf when they began securing the city there. I'm with an aviation unit out in the desert, and it was really quite a shock rolling into town. Rolling into Najaf today and just seeing, you know, everybody on the streets, everybody waving, giving the thumbs up. It's not clear, you know, one never knows sometimes whether that's simply out of fear that the Americans might take them for hostiles. But literally, virtually every single person we drove by were giving thumbs up and shouting, hopefully positive things. Certainly with smiles on their faces. And so it's certainly not surprising that in these cities, these are largely Shia cities, that and holy cities for Shia believers, that they would be pretty happy to see the back of Saddam Hussein. So it sounds as though the response in Karbala is quite similar to that in Najaf.
Well, Colin Soloway, thanks very much for being with us. Appreciate it.
No problem.
Colin Soloway is a reporter for Newsweek magazine, and he's with the 101st Airborne Division in central Iraq. Tom Jelton at the Pentagon, I did want to ask you about another thing coming out of the briefing. That was the briefing earlier with Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and General Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And that was over the future Iraqi government. And it seemed from what Secretary of Defense had to say that this is all but decided.
Yeah, Neil, this has been a matter of great controversy within the past few days. I know from my own reporting and from others as well that there has been real tension between the civilian leadership here at the Pentagon and the State Department people who are involved in the future of Iraq work, and also even with General Garner's office. General Jay Garner is a retired Army general who has been put in charge of sort of assembling a new civil administration in Iraq. And the work that he and his people have is to select people to run these various ministries in the Iraqi government. I mean, we have the U.S. government essentially taking over the whole state of Iraq here very shortly, and a new government has to be put together. And the key decision is who's going to be in charge. And there has been tremendous tension, I understand, between these various agencies and players in this process. Secretary Rumsfeld was a bit defensive, I think, today, because he has been criticized anonymously by a number of people as having vetoed the selection, or other people close to him as having vetoed the selection of certain people in those positions. He denied that today, and he also said that it is simply not true that the United States, in his word, is going to impose an Iraqi government on Iraq. But he did say that particularly with respect to a number, as you say, a number of the more non-controversial agencies in Iraq. He mentioned the agriculture ministry in particular. Basically, that the plan has all been worked out, and they do already have people lined up to take over that ministry. The question of the intelligence services and the defense ministry in Iraq, that's obviously another story.
When we come back from a break, Tom Jelton will stick around for a while and take some of your calls. Also, retired Colonel Sam Gardner will join us, and later we'll find out what's going on in Afghanistan, if that's a precedent for Iraq. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the latest news from Iraq. Later in the program, in a briefing earlier today from the Department of Defense, the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, specifically cited Afghanistan as a precedent for what's going to happen in the future, in the near future of Iraq. Later in the program, Ashraf Ghani, the finance minister of Afghanistan, will join us to talk about the process of reconstruction in his country and whether promises have been delivered. Well, still with us on the subject of Iraq is NPR's national security correspondent Tom Gelton from the Pentagon, and here in Studio 3A, our guest is Colonel Sam Gardner, a retired Air Force colonel and a consultant to the Department of Defense. And Sam, always good of you to join us.
Neil, thank you.
And we wanted to get to some questions from listeners. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Francis in Kansas City.
Hi.
Hi.
Love your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to bring up one issue here. I'm a native of Belgium, and therefore I read the internet voraciously and read all kinds of different sites and different languages. I just noticed something on the news site of a Dutch newspaper, and it said that the theory they have is that somehow there are more troops, American troops, already in Iraq than we are led to believe. And their source seems to be Orbat.com, the discussion site.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that, for instance, the 3rd Infantry Division would probably have two or three extra brigades already, probably from the 1st Cavalry and the 1st Armored. And they also are speculating that the 4th Infantry Division may actually already be at least partially there, using equipment of the maritime prepositioning ships in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm. Tom, well, let's get Tom Gelton from the Pentagon. Have you had any news of these other units being taken to Iraq? And would there be any reason for them to be there sub rosa?
I can't imagine that there would be, Neil. General Myers said today that at this point there are over 340,000 coalition forces in the region. Now, that is a very sizable number, and it's up about 40,000 since in the last 2.5 weeks since hostilities began. So obviously troops are continuing to come into the Gulf region. He said of those, more than 125,000 are inside Iraq. That's also an increase from the number that was going in early on. So as far as the 1st Armored Division, I'd be very surprised if there are any units from the 1st Armored Division already inside Iraq, because they are, I'm not even sure that they have left Germany yet. The 4th Infantry Division, some of their people have been arriving from Texas, but I would also be surprised that they have gotten very far into Iraq. I really don't know why the U.S. military would want to deceive people on how many troops are in Iraq. I mean, this is the whole thrust of this operation has been to emphasize the overwhelming power of the coalition war effort, the United States, Britain, and Australia, and the inevitability of the defeat of the Iraqi forces. So underestimating the size of the U.S. and allied force would not seem to serve that purpose.
Sam Gardner?
I think, Neil, there may be a point that France has, which is actually a strategic point. I understand the 4th Infantry Division, the division that had been going to land in Turkey, is pretty well completed its unloading. They've been unloading in Kuwait for a week. They, as I understand reports, have a mission to go actually north of Baghdad to their original objective, which is Tikrit. It's about 350 miles, but they could very well be in the battle in 4 to 5 days if they move at the speed that other units moved as they went to Baghdad. So there's a strategic force entering very, very quickly.
Francis?
Yes, the newspaper article really pointed out, look, they wanted to give the Iraqi regime the idea that Baghdad would be a medium-term objective, that they would wait a little bit, wait for reinforcements. However, if they would have these extra kind of secret brigades already there, then they could do what they're doing right now, which is, with a lot more force, go for it already right now instead of, say, next week or 2 weeks from now. And that would be the reason to not mention that these troops were already there.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Kevin, and Kevin's in Santa Rosa, California.
Good morning, or good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question that really goes to address the very large political component to this this campaign, and that is that if we are to win the peace after the battle has been won, and since it seems as if we've demonstrated very superior military capability and our ability to basically take out Iraqi resistance where we find it, is there a point where we might adopt a tactic which would seek to minimize the casualties that we're inflicting on the actual Iraqi military troops, with an eye toward the fact that presumably all of these soldiers will have family who will not want to see their loved ones killed unnecessarily? And when I say unnecessarily, I think about the first incursion into Baghdad, where the objective was to demonstrate that we could enter the city, and there were reports of perhaps 1,000 to 3,000Iraqi soldiers killed, and that seems a large number of casualties to inflict when we know that we need to gain the confidence of the civilian population.
Sam, do you want to try
well,
that?
I sure will, Kevin. I think you're on to an excellent point. It just reminds me that something we have to keep reminding ourselves, that the occupying power has the responsibility for the citizens of the country after they occupy. Those hospitals in Baghdad, which are filling up with casualties, in a week or two will be American hospitals, in the sense that we'll be responsible for their care. Now, the problem, the tension, Kevin, is the fact that to wait is also to cause problems. To wait is to cause tensions in the humanitarian system. Baghdad has been without electricity and water since the 3rd of April. If we wait too long, we could have a humanitarian disaster on our hands that would be larger than, in fact, the casualties if we hurry. So there's a real tension that has to be balanced as you work the final battles for the war.
And I just should remind people that we have reports that the hospitals we're talking about, overwhelmed as they may be and lacking anesthetic, but they do have electricity from generators supplied for exactly this
yes,
contingency.
Yes.
Yeah. Kevin?
I want to thank you for the response. It seems that even at a point where we've demonstrated that we can go where we will, that we and I realize that there are issues with truly securing the city and the roadways and the airports and but they're just it can be even in the United States press you can get the impression that there's just incredible carnage being inflicted on the other side, and there comes a point when people, even who may support this action, and I have to say that I didn't support it from the beginning, but I feel that now that we're there, we need to do the job properly and as humanely as possible, that even people who may have supported it will begin to recoil at the massive casualties that we're inflicting. You can become sort of desensitized to the casualties by if you simply think of we've destroyed this this position, we've neutralized that force, and you have to remember that every time you talk about a tank or resistance, that there are real human lives that are behind those things.
Kevin, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Joining us now from Baghdad is Craig Nelson, who reports for Cox Newspapers. It's very late there. Thanks very much for staying up and staying with us.
Hello, Neil.
What can you tell us about the past 24 hours? What have they been like? What have you been able to see?
Well, the past 24 hours have been highlighted by the Iraqi Information Minister, Mohammed Saeed al-Sahaf, standing on the roof of the Palestine Hotel this morning and telling reporters that American forces were being defeated. He said, "We besieged them and killed most of them, and we will slaughter them all and bury them in Iraq." And if he had only turned about 2 feet and looked about a half mile away across the Tigris River, he would have seen four Bradley tanks sitting on the embankment next to Saddam Hussein's main Republican palace, having seized that corner of the palace. So it was one of those otherworldly moments. It seemed like the information minister was caught in a room of funhouse mirrors. The situation was directly opposite of what he was describing.
And as far as you could tell, was that the point, or did U.S. forces have wider objectives in the city of Baghdad?
I don't know. That's the question we have here. It's not clear tonight whether the American forces who went into the Republican Palace this morning have stayed there tonight. But I think there's a confusion. I think there's some confusion about U.S. objectives because while the U.S. says that it's demonstrating its ability to go into Baghdad at will and move at will, the Iraqis have an equally valid argument in some sense when they say that we repel them because the United States has made it a military strategy, has made a point of withdrawing almost every night. So I think it's left Iraqis sort of confused. I think you find a lot of denial on the streets. The streets are mostly deserted, but the people you do find to talk to say that, A, they're not sure what American forces are doing, and, B, that Iraqi forces will eventually prevail because, look, the American forces haven't been able to seize any control of any territory in Baghdad.
What are you hearing about the situation? We were just talking about it earlier in terms of the hospitals in Baghdad. How difficult are they finding the situation? And in general, about the humanitarian situation, water, electricity, food?
Well, we hear the situation is horrific. And the main problem is not, as we understand it here, in the center of Baghdad, it's not necessarily electricity, it's not necessarily water. It's the fact that doctors and nurses can't get to the hospitals because of the fighting. The hospital official we spoke with earlier today said that he was trying to urge his doctors and nurses to bring their families to the hospitals and stay there 24 hours and keep working. But the doctors and nurses feel divided loyalties. They want to stay with their families in the outlying districts and away from the hospital. So it's a real dilemma. I think one of the big problems is just staffing these hospitals because water and electricity aren't the main problem right at the moment.
Is there any way for you to estimate or you know have any understanding about the extent of casualties, killed and wounded amongst Iraqi civilians and for that matter amongst Iraqi fighters?
No, the numbers, the Iraqi authorities have sort of assiduously avoided stating any casualties of soldiers. In fact, we've been, any time we try to get into a hospital where there are soldiers being treated, we've been turned away. As far as civilians are concerned, no, they in recent days they stopped giving us numbers for civilian casualties. And it's a very difficult subject because we do know, and from eyewitness reports, we've seen the Iraqis move Scud missile launchers into residential neighborhoods. We've seen schools and hospitals and some facilities, so-called civilian facilities, evacuated. And eyewitnesses in the neighborhood tell us that soldiers have moved into these places. So this whole question about civilian casualties is a very, very complex one, and the numbers are only the start of it.
Craig, finally, we're going to let you go, but I did want to ask you before we do, what does it look like tonight as you look out your window?
It's pitch dark. There's not all the power is out in the city. The palace grounds that were the scene of so much fighting this morning are completely dark. The streets are absolutely deserted.
Craig Nelson reports for Cox Newspapers. He joined us on the line from Baghdad. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Neil.
We're going to continue talking with Colonel Sam Gardner about the situation in Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We had to say goodbye to NPR's Tom Jelton, who had other tasks to get to there at the Pentagon, but Colonel Gardner is good enough to be with us still. And I wanted to begin with an email question, and that had to do with this from Peter Garnham in Amagansett, New York. I'm curious to know why coalition forces have allowed Iraqi television to continue broadcasting. Its only purpose seems to be a pipeline for Saddam Hussein's alleged appearances. Why not take it out?
Well, I think they actually wanted to, Neil. It was a very strange thing. At first, they seemed not to want to, and then they seem to want to, but haven't been able to find the ability to do it. But a footnote, with the electricity off, it is not doing anything anyway. So even if they're broadcasting, I understand that Iraq had rented some time on some broadcast satellites. And therefore, what they were really doing is broadcasting to a satellite and making the broadcast from there. So it was not the kind of high-tech thing that you would envision of a television studio broadcasting, a little bit like the embeddeds.
Let me ask you also specifically about the humanitarian situation, and I know this is something that you've studied, and particularly about the electricity grid. There was charges when the lights went off in Baghdad last week. We didn't do it. No, you did it. They did.
Well, I think they're all right. I don't think the U.S. targeted the electrical grid. I think what probably happened, Neil, was two things. One of them was that the electrical system in all of Iraq, the grid, was very fragile. That could have just come apart. It requires people to be on top of the system and to manage it very carefully. Once the telephone went down, that was probably no longer possible to do that. The consequence then, and this is the point I had made earlier about the water system, once the electricity goes off the grid, then you have problems with the water plants. And the water plants, and that's what you're beginning to see in all of the towns in the south, and that is people without water. Not so bad in Baghdad. Baghdad has always had a pretty good water system, but the south has not.
Let's get a question from Joe, who's on the line in Raleigh, North Carolina. And Joe, I'm going to have to ask you to keep it quick.
Okay. I just want to touch base on the fact what the other gentleman was saying before, the reporter, and I want to just express the fact that there's a different tactical objective between a raid and an attack. When you're doing a raid, is what they're doing in Baghdad, your objective is not to occupy. Your objective is to go in there and come out. So there's a big difference, and that's why they send to repel us, but that's not a repel. That was our objective, is to go in and leave. The other thing I just want to touch on was the gentleman before who talked about 4th Infantry Division using pre-positioned equipment afloat. That's not the actual case. It was their actual equipment shipped from Fort Hood, Texas, not actual pre-positioned. So that was a foul on what he said there.
Yes. Now, that was among the things that may have been incorrect in that report he was reading from a Dutch newspaper. Thanks very much, Joe.
Thank you.
Okay. Difference between a raid and an attack. Is he right?
Well, certainly. I think the more important thing is the what's sort of being discussed today is the difference between Basra and Baghdad. When the British went in on these raids, their objective was to take city leaders. Our objective is to send a message right now. And I sort of wonder about sending messages, which we've been trying to do all the way through the war. People may not be getting them.
Colonel Sam Gardner, a retired Air Force colonel, consultant to the Department of Defense, thanks very much for being with us again. When we come back from a short break, we'll turn to a subject we'll all be looking at all week. Reconstruction of war-torn countries. As the Bush administration looks ahead to rebuilding Iraq, we'll be joined by Afghanistan's finance minister on the rebuilding effort underway in his country. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.